Oilers. We're the Houston Oilers. Houston Oilers. Houston Oilers number one. Yes, we're the Houston Oilers. Houston Oilers. Houston Oilers number one.
Hello, everyone. You're listening to Battle Red Radio. I'm Matt Weston. Tonight, I'm joined by Troy, as you know, as Texans Cap. How are you doing tonight, Troy?
Oh, doing good, man. Thanks for having me.
Yeah, I'm excited to do this. I had a lot of fun on your show last week, and we did like a home and away series to have you on tonight, and it's been, you know, something that I should have done a long time ago, but it's never too late at all to have a good podcast and talk to somebody who has is very intelligent, has a really good niche too, and is the answers for something that's confusing and that people have a lot of questions about typically.
No, I appreciate the kind words. Yeah, no, I'll follow along with the Battle Red blog for quite a few number of years now, and you know, y'all put out great quality content, and you know, happy to be on here with you.
Yeah, so this week we watched the Texans get blanked by the Indianapolis Colts, 31-0, and it was a game that was really similar to the first time these two teams played, where the Colts ran the ball well. The Texans had some problems stopping the run, except this time they at least didn't give up the big plays. Carson Wentz, you know, barely threw for 150 yards. The Texans had problems running the football against some of the best run defenses in the league, and they also did that thing too, where they did not attack the weakest part of the Colts defense, which is stopping the vertical passes. And you know, both Tyrod Taylor and Davis Mills, you know, didn't even attempt your passes down the deeper sideline parts of the field. So Tyrod Taylor was 5 of 13 for 45 yards and an interception the first throw of the game, and he took two sacks. He had a QBR of 2.7. He hurt his wrist, supposedly, and was in the Big Blue medical tent up in the sky with David Johnson, and he wasn't seen from again. After that came in Davis Mills, and he was 6 for 14 for 49 yards, averaging 3.5 yards an attempt, took two sacks, and had a QBR 6.2, but he did not throw an interception. Both of their box scores were nearly identical. It was kind of bizarre, like they were, you know, identical twins separated at birth. Who do you think had the better game this one, if you had to pick one of the two?
Oh, do I really have to pick one?
Yeah, you have to pick one.
Yeah, no, then Mills did. I mean, Tyrod, he's just definitely not the same since coming back from his injury. And, you know, that interception on the first play of the game was just a clear indication of where he's at with this offense, with Tim Kelly, with this team. It just, he was, you know, portrayed as a leader, very calm, very, you know, suited for this type of culture rebuild. And he's starting to almost look a little disinterested. And I think Davis Mills had the better game just from, you know, his command of the huddle, command of the offense from what little there was, you know. And, you know, Davis Mills is Davis Mills, but he at least pushed the ball down the field just a hair bit more than Taylor. And, you know, as you said, didn't attack the vertical lines, didn't really attack the middle of the field. You know, as we saw, I don't even think Taylor even targeted or had a reception to a wide receiver. Mm-hmm. and his five completions were to tight end and running back. So, yeah, I mean, at this point, it's Mills, and it's got to be Mills going forward. We heard Culley today talk about, you know, Taylor couldn't grip the ball, but they said it was his left hand. And then I saw Rapport said that they were doing an MRI for potential ligament damage. So all that tells me, you know, maybe Taylor could play through the pain, but what's the point? What would be the reasoning for keeping Taylor at this point when you clearly have been saying that whoever gives you the best chance to win is who should be playing? And Taylor is not giving you any more of a chance to win than what Mills can bring. So to me, it feels like it's got to be Mills the rest of the way on out.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and that's what I was going to allude to that too. David Culley was saying that, you know, they're going to go with the quarterback who gave him the best chance to win. And so, you know, you kind of made clear that you agree with the statement, and you want to see Mills play with Taylor. I guess I also make the point, like, both these guys are bad. You know, like, we watched Davis Mills start, and he lost every start that he had. The one, you know, game where he actually looked like a quarterback was against the New England Patriots, where they didn't blitz a whole lot until the second half, and he made, you know, one deep throw off a flea flicker that was, you know, a good throw in stride, and then he made two throws he's never made in his entire life before. And aside from that, you know, he hasn't thrown the ball downfield really well at all, or even have the opportunity to do so, which was his best skill at Stanford, I thought. And then aside from that deep throw down the sideline to Brandon Cooks, and they were down by 30 points, like that's it from him as well, too. And so, like, no matter what you pick here, it's going to probably be a team where you may not win a game for the rest of the year, even as bad as the Jaguars are playing. And if you're in that set of circumstances anyways, why not go with the younger guy here who has the chance of some, like, idea of or illusion potential that I don't really think exists at all, but at least, like, you're playing the guy who's 23 instead of 32.
Yeah, I mean, you've got to continue that evaluation of Mills, and this is your perfect opportunity. You know, you hear some analysts say that he faced a pretty rough set of defenses during his starts, and you know, if we come in forward, then he has a few softer defenses that he can go up against with Seattle and Jacksonville coming up. But you've got to continue the evaluation. You know what you have in Taylor. I mean, it's not going to change, and. Mm-hmm. You know, and I was earlier in the season, I was, you know, on the Tyrod Taylor train. Yeah, let's bring him back next year. In my opinion, week in, you know, week by week, it's just lessening and lessening. And now I'd rather just see them find another bridge option for 2022, like we talked about the other night.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I don't think Taylor's should even be considered for 2022. So if you consider that mindset, then it's got to be Mills, both from an evaluation standpoint. And that you already know what you have in Taylor.
Yeah, I agree with that too. And I mean, I think the biggest difference between Taylor and Mills, you know, compared to the first part of the week whenever, you know, Mills took over. And I mean, he still got the chance to play against the Colts, who have a bad, you know, pass defense. But really, like, just like Tim Kelly's inability to scheme any open throws from it all and just chaining them to, you know, four passing concepts, you know? And it's like, it's a sprint right rollout. It's the drag over the middle. It's the slant against cover three. It's the screen pass. Like, those are the only four passing concepts they ran at all. And it's very easy to defend if you're going to be that mundane with the offense, too. But so, since Taylor has returned, the Texans have scored 9, 22, 14, and 0 points, despite forcing 12 turnovers. Of course, in that game against the Titans, when they scored 22, they forced 5 turnovers in that one. Do you think there's a chance that Tim Kelly loses his play calling duties? Is there anything out there that you think Tim Kelly does well as an offensive coordinator?
For the first question on losing his play calling duties, I mean, we got to look at it, you know, behind him would be Pep Hamilton, who hasn't called plays. If we exclude his XFL work, he hasn't called plays, I think. Yeah, I mean, well, I guess that's, but I mean, he hasn't really called plays for a good number of years. So whether or not, you know, he can step in and take over that role, maybe so. Would it change things up? I don't know. But, you know, I don't – if you think of it from that aspect, yeah, he could lose his play calling duties. But do I think Coley's going to take the reins away from him? No. I think Coley's going to stick with him for the rest of the year. There's really nothing – you know, he keeps standing up for Coley. I mean, again, today is saying that it's execution and coaching. It's not the scheme, and mm-hmm. which is hard to take in as a fan, you know, to listen to that over and over when the scheme is clearly not working. But should he lose playing calling duties? Sure. I mean, maybe send a message, but I don't know that there's really anything to be had from taking play calling duties away from him and bringing in Hamilton.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I don't, and like the Hamilton thing too, you know, that's one thing that is a grievance of mine in the offseason whenever they hire a position coach and people get excited about it and are very, you know, looking forward to X position coach and how he's going to do this. But we don't know what they do at all, you know. Like, I can't sit here and say Pep Hamilton's good or isn't or should take over as the play calling duties at all. But, I mean, just Tim Kelly's been so bad. And just even, like, the decision to hire him, to him next year as, like, a half-part appeasement to Deshaun Watson was silly. And, like, the only good game he really has had as a play caller was the game against Jacksonville where he did a very, very elementary thing of just scheming rub routes against man coverage with a defense that was, like, new and young and inexperienced and couldn't pass, you know, routes at all from one another out of the pistol. And aside from that, in the screen pass he had against Cleveland, he really hasn't designed a good game plan at all this year. And the run game's been a mess. The pass concepts have been simple. They don't do a very good job, you know, with man coverage beaters and even like the cover four, cover seven stuff. We talked about against the Jets last week when they took away the entirety of their middle of the field passing game just by using a robber in cover four. Just like things that aren't like super crazy at all against bad defenses, and they've still had problems with it too. But like, I think Tim Kelly should be, you know, like go and be able to switch around to somebody else, but I don't think they're going to do it as well either.
Is he still, this is probably a question that you'd be able to answer better than us. He's still running that, what O'Brien ran with that Yankee concept with the two receivers, one that, you know, goes deep and one runs the post where they're crossing 20-30 yards down the field. He ran that as a staple with Hopkins and Fuller.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Are they still running that today?
That's like something that you run, you know, against cover three. Off the top of my head, I think they ran it once against the Jaguars, and they kind of ran something similar against the Jets last week to create that, you know, open throw to Collins. And that one to, or the one to Cooks, where they had, you know, the two crossers, but it was a lot like skinnier, and it was more like a vertical like post instead of that typical Yankee concept. But they haven't done a whole lot, and they just haven't had teams play a lot of cover three against them though, because they can't run the football, and there's no point to play cover three unless you need the eighth guy to stop the run.
Yeah, no, that's exactly it. And so, yeah, and it. That would be my one question. And, you know, unfortunately, this past week we saw, you know, the one time that Taylor was able to connect with a wide receiver and Collins, he lined up on the line of scrimmage and covered up the mm-hmm. tight end. So, you know, it's just the way – that's just a kind of a signifier of what's happening with this team, that the one time they get a good, you know, good gain, good play, they get it pulled back on a penalty that was very simple and stupid.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I'm like, still, it doesn't even seem real that Tyrod Taylor started, didn't complete one pass to a wide receiver. Yeah, Farrell Brown had that fumble as well, too. And then Mills comes in and completes three passes to Brandon Cooks, and that's it. They only had three receptions by a wide receiver, and they rolled to Brandon Cooks last week. And it's just like, it's something that just seems so, like, impossible in a professional football situation. And this isn't like Alabama State playing Alabama. This is two professional football teams playing against one another.
Yeah, exactly. And maybe things will change under Hamilton. I don't know. I don't know that the scheme with the run concepts that they continue to try to use are going to work. Who knows? And maybe, like you said, I mean, maybe it's worth a shot. I mean, you figure maybe this team has got one more win in them for the rest of the year. You know, maybe they won't have any more wins, and Detroit can sneak another win out and bump the Texans up the draft board. But, you know, we'll see. We'll see what happens. As of today, I don't think he's going to do it.
Yeah, I guess the one good thing about Hamilton, just knowing his background, especially being from Stanford, you'd think that he could at least scheme like a power run attack, you know, and like I've talked about all year this year, is that the Texans have run a little bit of everything in the passing game and the run game after they tried being an outside zone team that failed, you know, miserably. And now they do a little bit of everything. They're kind of bad at it all. And it's how it was like during the Bill O'Brien era, where they didn't have, you know, a central run scheme that they could always hang their hat on. And they're doing kind of the same thing this year too. But I think Hamilton, just with his Stanford ties, they could run a lot more power, a lot more counter, a lot more dart, you know, and run more, you know, two and three tie in personnel formations that may actually have the guys knowing who to block, you know. And that's the only thing about Hamilton. You expect a lot of play action too, that, you know, maybe there's something there at all, but I don't think we're going to see it.
No, and I think, you know, people kind of lean on what Justin Herbert did under him when he was the QB coach, and you kind of just carry over that expectation. And, you know, and unfortunately, that was just a great situation. Herbert has turned out to be a very good potential, very good quarterback. And I think a lot of fans saw that and was bringing it over and thought, oh, he's going to do the same over here. And that's just not the case.
Yeah. It's like, well, Herbert's like a transcendental quarterback, you know, with his arm strength and everything else. And it was the efficiency-cation of Joe Lombardi that's kind of newer to him to start the season off for the first 11 weeks. And he at least like threw the ball downfield last week. And that was the big difference in that Bengals game. So the Texans had another new offensive line iteration this week, with Justin McCray out with the concussion and Justin Britt back in the lineup replacing Jimmy Morsey. We had Tyus Howard at left tackle, Lane Taylor at left guard, Justin Britt at center, Max Sharping at right guard, and Charlie Heck at right tackle. Against a great run defense, the Texans backs only had 13 carries for 42 yards. And this wasn't the typical Texans game, or a game where they went down like 21-0 in the first quarter. They just gave up 7 points every quarter. And so it is kind of surprising, considering that they were down by, you know, 14 through the first half of it, that they only had 13 carries. But these came out to 3.2 yards a carry, and they had DVOA below negative 30% again. Indy's front also had 11 quarterback hits, 4 sacks, and 4 tackles for a loss. How do you think this offensive line configuration fared? Did you watch much about the offensive line specifically when you were watching this offense twirl around?
Yeah, I mean, Britt definitely seemed to be a minor step up above Morrissey. You know, him and Taylor in the left side with Howard seemed to be a little more put together than the previous, 8 iterations. So I think this is iteration number 9. You know, Heck still had some issues out there on the right side. The one person that actually kind of surprised me was Sharping. He seemed to have a little more get up in his step, and he was getting to the second level on a few of the runs. And, you know, it was a welcome sight to see. It's not what we would expect out of a second round draft pick, you know, in his third year in the league. But I mean, absent not having Tunsil available, this is probably your best offensive line group that we've seen this year, in my opinion.
Okay. Yeah, I just watched Tyus Howard pass protect. It was pretty much the only thing I watched in the offense on the field, and didn't have much of an eye for the rest of it, but I'll make sure to watch it tomorrow. So let's say, if this is your favorite offensive line combination, you know, basically the Texans currently have here, with Laremy Tunsil on the roster, if he was back to health, actually, what would your ideal Texans offensive line combination be?
I would shift Howard back to right tackle if Tunsil has to come back and play, and leave the interior three as is. I mean, McCray and Sharping are almost interchangeable at this point. I don't know that Cole Toner or anybody else on this roster is a better guard than McCray or Sharping, unfortunately. So that would be my one change if Tunsil did come back, would shift Howard out to the right tackle.
Yeah. Personally, just because of my own hatred in my heart, I would just keep Laremy Tunsil just sideline the rest of the year.
Yeah, so I didn't know that was an option.
Yeah, yeah. You can take it however you want to take it.
Yeah, I mean, we heard it today, and it was because I think I tweeted it. I think Coley actually said it was a personal decision, so, is playing into some of whether or not Tunsil's playing. Mm-hmm. And I'd already been on the record that I think Tunsil's done for the year. I don't think he wants to come back. There's nothing for him to gain coming back this season. There's only things for him to lose, and that's from an injury standpoint, mm-hmm. or putting worse tape out there for any potential trade partners or whatever may happen in the offseason. So there's, and the team at this point, you might as well do the evaluation on Howard at left tackle in case you make a move with Tunsil in the offseason. So there's really nothing to gain for the team or for Tunsil to come back and play another snap this year. So given all that, you know, I don't see any I personally don't think Tunsil's going to come back this year. There's nothing for him to come back to.
Yeah, that's a great point. And we had a Twitter question from @FoundOfHOUSports, and I guess the way David Coley described it was a day-by-day situation. This is the tweet from the young beat reporter. I can't remember his name. It's on my head. But that's a day-by-day.
Brooks.
Yeah, Brooks. It was a day-by-day situation with star left tackle Laremy Tunsil returned from the injury reserve. He had thumb surgery in mid-October and was expected to miss 4 weeks. Coley said it's a combination of personal decision and medical staff advice.
That was the one I quote tweeted, yeah.
Yeah, what a hilarious sentence. But he said some thoughts on Tunsil this gem. And, like, yeah, I agree. I don't think there's a point for Tunsil to play at all. And you're better off with, you know, Howard out there at left tackle. And I think he could just be, like, you know, 90% of Tunsil as a pass protector over there. You know, I think he got kind of shocked by Ronald Blair against the Jets last week. But I'd rather see Howard out there left tackle and trade Tunsil, you know, next season. And, like, I've been on, like, the bandwagon that, you know, whenever the trade that happened, that left tackles are important, but they're not that important. That, you know, $21 million, 2 first-round picks, and a second-round pick for a non-quarterback position is, you know, insane. And, like, Tunsil's game is that he's a top-10 pass protector, but he's pretty meek as a run blocker and just, like, isn't, you know, nasty enough. And that's an important part of playing the offensive line position. And especially, like, if he's, like, your leader and kind of the guy everybody looks up to in the offensive line, he's, you know, kind of playing patty cake. I think kind of, like, pushes, has kind of, like, a domino effect as far as the entire mentality of the offensive line goes. But, you know, I think it'd be best, like you mentioned, too, where he sits out the rest of the year, you trade him next year, I think you get a late first round pick or an early second round pick for him, considering his contract. I think Jackson will be a really good spot, even if he got pick, 34, 35 out of it. I just don't know which teams towards like the end of the draft or would want to actually trade, a first round pick for Tensel and take on that contract as well too.
Yeah, I think somebody had asked me about that today and I didn't really have an answer, and a late one, early two probably makes a little bit of sense. I would lean more towards a two at this point because he's due $36.3 million over the next 2 years. Mm. And, that's a big chunk of money. B, the short-term contract that the Texans gave him, that three-year extension is going to come back and bite him because any team, not only had taken on that $36 million, with $10 million of it's guaranteed right off the bat, you're going to probably have to extend him after 2022. So not only are you giving up, let's just say a top of the, top 10 in the second round, pick 32 or 33 through 40, you give up that pick. You're going to get him for 2 years at least at a minimum, but you had to give him a new extension after 1 year. And he's very, very savvy when it comes to the business side of things. He's got a lot of hands in his a lot of cookie jars with his hand in when it comes to business outside of football. He's big into fashion. He's big into a lot of that exposure. So I say that to say that his next contract is going to be another very strong contract, even if he just continues the performance and the type of play that he's putting out there right now, where you say, and I agree with you that he's a top five when it comes to pass blocking. He's middle of the pack when it comes to run blocking. So is he really a top three left tackle? Probably not, but he's paid like it, and his next contract, he's going to get paid like it again. So it's going to be, you have to find a really comfortable spot for a team to take all that on, the money, the new potential new contract and the draft pick. So hopefully the team can find a trade partner for him. Unfortunately, Nick Caserio pushed some more money out with a full restructure on him. So if they trade him next year, they'll still save roughly $10 million on the cap if they trade him, because Tunsil's got a $26 million cap charge in 2022 and with $16 million in debt. So
it's crazy.
You get almost $10 million back in savings. But, at the end of the day, that's probably the move that's going to have to be made. And then that's why the evaluation on Howard is so important now, because it helps you decide, is he a left tackle? Is he a right tackle? Is he here beyond that? Because the team has a critical decision with Howard as well. Come May of 2022, they need to make a decision on his fifth year option.
Mm-hmm.
And with this new CBA, it's fully guaranteed soon as they hit the option. And I think his option for 2023, is going to be $12.7 million, which by tackle standards, that's easy to take on. That's not a big deal, but you're committing, that money becomes fully guaranteed at the time. So you're committing almost $15 million in May of next year through 2023. So that's something the team has to, that's why there's so many factors in this, is you've got to find a training partner for Tunsil. You've got to decide, is Howard your left tackle or is he your right tackle? And if whichever one he is he in your future plans? And if he is, do you do the fifth year option or are you just make him play out on the last year and then look at a franchise tag option in 2023 if he finds a way to improve? The franchise tag is going to be $16-17 million. So there's a lot of fluctuating factors mm-hmm. there. The team's going to have to, Caserio is going to have to really dive into when it comes to the offseason, determining around what to do with Tunsil and Howard.
Yeah, I think the fifth-year option thing makes it more imperative. I didn't know they changed it to guaranteed, where you see teams, make the fifth-year option decision, and then once the next year rolls around, they would just cut them, and then the money's not guaranteed that fifth year, and there's really, no lose-lose at all for the team if they make that fifth-year option. But with that change, it kind of changes that part of it, too. Looking at the Tensil trade partners as well next year, if you look at the top 10 part of the draft, the Lions don't need left tackle, but the Jaguars do. Cam Robinson is I think he's the Mendoza line of left tackles. If Cam Robinson's your left tackle, that's fine. You can't get any worse than Cam Robinson be able to have a functioning offense. And so he's going to be a free agent next year. And so I couldn't imagine them retaining him. And you think they would look into free agency with $70 million in cap space, or be in the Tensil sweepstakes. Maybe that pick 35 is good enough for that. And the Panthers are another team because they're ninth as of right now at 5-7. They have, you know, historically, you know, bad offensive line play right now. And I'll never forget them for trading for Sam Darnold, giving up draft capital for Sam Darnold just to put him behind a bad offensive line all over again. And we already know what that looks like. And the other team, and those are really the only two teams here that could use a left tackle picking the top 10.
I would put
the Jaguars.
Seahawks in there. I would put the Seahawks in there because I think this is Dwayne Brown's last year, and it remains to be seen if they're going to. They didn't want to extend him this year. They just reworked his contract. So
yeah, the Jets have their first. I guess they could trade their second round pick though. Yeah, that makes sense.
Yeah, I would put the Seahawks in there, like you said, the Panthers. The Giants potentially, not the Falcons, not the Vikings, not the Saints. It'd be fun to have the Dolphins back involved in this. So, I mean, there's a few potential suitors out there, but it's not as many as you would initially hope at first scan.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think it's gonna be there. Like it's gonna be available for them to be able to move on from them. But it's just kind of making the last little bit of work. I think the most annoying thing about Tensil though, like I think he's just been kind of a just weird player in Houston where he looks the part, you know, like he should be so much better than what his actual performance is. And he kind of like, he gives up on blocks after a couple seconds and let us some, you know, sacks of Watson that should have occurred, you know, previously. And just again, just like how meek he was as a linebacker, as a run blocker was just so frustrating considering, you know, his athleticism, his strength, his feet, his quickness. It just never fully made any sense how his performance worked here in Houston.
Yeah, I completely agree. I mean, it's hard to figure him out. It's hard to figure out what he just needs to be. And I think what I had said earlier today was if you can find a spot for him where he's motivated, then the sky's the limit for him. He just needs to have that right situation where he's motivated. He has a good market around him, and I say market from a business aspect. So maybe if you can get him into a New York, you know, Boston area, you know, something with a good external market for him to flex his business ventures might give him more motivation from an overall player standpoint.
It's crazy that he can make, you know, he can make $14 million of a cap hit this year. And it still isn't enough, you know. Or no, not for, he has $9 million this year, but he can make, you know, $26 million next year. That's still not enough motivation. I guess Seattle could work out as well too for him because he loves to wear those rock T-shirts and flannels, and so I think he fit in, you know, up there too as a potential, you know, bridge from, Dwayne Brown. He could always play right tackle over there for a year, I guess.
Oh goodness, there you go.
they can make it work out some way to give him the T-shirts that he likes to wear.
Yep.
So this was another game for the Texans with Carson Wentz where he'd have to break 200 passing yards for the Colts to score 31 points and win. He only had 16 completions for 151 yards, and he pretty much just forced Michael Pittman in the passing game this week. It was one of the rare times where T.Y. Hilton didn't completely, you know, devour him. Jonathan Taylor, Nyheim Hines, and Neon Jackson combined for 41 carries for 186 yards and 4.5 yards a carry. Defensively, I think this game was just like kind of exactly what you expected, in that they would run the ball really well and they wouldn't really need to throw it at all. Was there anything defensively in this one that surprised or interested you?
Nothing really jumped out at me. I mean, you know, Malik Collins had another good game. He was, you know, pushing his way into the backfield some. You know, it's tough to know because we only saw three quarters of the starting group before they started rotating in the back, you know, some of the other players. You saw a lot of, I don't know if you want to call them second string, but a lot of depth players in the back end of third quarter and fourth quarter. You know, we saw players like Jimmy Moreland and Garrett Wallow out there, and Jonathan Owens getting a lot of, you know, getting some snaps. But, you know, Terrence Mitchell had a rough game, unfortunately, and Eric Murray came back to earth. He had another rough game.
I loved Eric Murray's little, like, whenever he gave that touchdown on that RPO, and it was kind of like close to the sideline, and he gave like the weakest incompletion arm wave I've ever seen in my entire life.
Yeah, I mean, he had like six quarters between the Titans game and the Jets game where he was, you know, people were thinking, oh, maybe the light bulb's coming on with him. He sat down and he came back after Lonnie Johnson got sat down and then shifted, so maybe something there, but it's not there. And you know, we saw Kevin Pierre-Louis out there as the first time he's had any meaningful snaps after the Cunningham benching slash paid suspension leave this week for missing the COVID test. So, you know, nothing really jumped out at me. You know, Grenard had a lot of pressures, just, you know, couldn't get home this week, finishing off his consecutive sack streak. But, you know, Tavier Thomas had a decent game, but it just nothing. There's nothing that really just jumped out at me that said, "Ooh, this guy had a game." It was just a lot of blah blah, you know. And from a defensive standpoint, it seems like this game, even with the two short fields right off the bat, that this game should have been a lot worse than 31 points given up.
Yeah, it's like it was just kind of the ideal, like a Colts game against a bad football team. The one thing you forgot about those, Cam McGregor-Hill having 20 tackles and Jack Easterby retweeting the record and then rescinding his retweet after that. Are you ready for McGregor-Hill to enter the Ring of Honor because Andre Johnson won't be welcome after his Jack Easterby your tweet from last year?
Yeah, that was, I mean, yeah, the team, I feel bad for the PR and for the social media team when they're having to really hype up those kind of things to find some kind of positive spin from the game. So, yeah, Grugiel Hill, you know, he's all over the place. He's a wild man. He's a maniac. Tons of tackles. That's great. Wonderful, you know, tackle machine. But I really can't say much beyond that. I mean, he did get in the backfield a couple times. He seems with his speed, when Lovey sends him, he does seem to find a way to find those creases off the stunts and get into the backfield when he does blitz, which is interesting. And he's since about week 3, week 4, he's been on my re-sign for the future list, and that continues on right now.
Yeah, he's just really smart too. Like a lot of this stuff, I think he really isn't, you know, a top athlete all by any means, but he reads his keys well, and then he gets downhill and attacks the ball whenever he does it. And it's been like he's been my favorite free agent signing. And I may have talked about last week, but it's just because I thought the signing was so silly at the time. And, you know, it's been one that actually worked out. But more often than not, the linebacker signings didn't work. And seeing Kevin Pierre-Louis out this week was kind of funny, just because when that Washington team, you know, I always say, like, you can just watch football. And with Washington, he was benched for John Bostic and Cole Holcomb, you know. And like, he was a coverage linebacker who couldn't cover there. And him getting the contract he got last year after being benched on that Washington defense that was notorious for bad linebacker play, was kind of funny. And so seeing him out there for Cunningham didn't really, you know, do anything at all for me. And then seeing Wallow out there, I've only seen Wallow in the field twice. One was whenever he got devoured on the goal line against New England, just like absolutely bulldozed. And then today he got, you know, caught up in a rub, trying to run out to the flat and defend throw to the running back that he was chasing on immediately. And so maybe we see some Garrett Wallow in the last, like, kind of five games of the season here too.
Yeah, I mean, it wouldn't shock me at all to see Cunningham either inactive more for the rest of the season, or he's going to be on a limited snap count. And I say that to say he has it's a $10 million injury guarantee in 2022.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, will vest into a full guarantee for skill cap, you know, for skill cap and injury come, I think, March 22nd. But the injury guarantee is already in place. And, you know, we've seen teams do this in the past where if they have an expensive injury guarantee on the following year, and the team is not doing well
at the end of the year,
they just kind of quietly just lower the snap count, make him inactive, you know, and just say, you know, and do the coach speak where, you know, we put the best players out there that we felt we needed to win, you know, scheme thing, blah, blah, blah. So it wouldn't shock me from that aspect, just from the money and the cap aspect, that they start heading that direction with Cunningham and this pseudo suspension, you know, for missing the COVID test was step one of that process. This should just help them get into that process. So the five games, you're either going to see, if you see Cunningham, it's going to be on a limited basis going forward.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and Cunningham too. I mean, that was whenever O'Brien signed him or they extended him, one of the things I was talking about at the time is that, you know, Cunningham is really good in a specific role. and that's him being as a will linebacker where he just has to, you know, swim past, you know, guards on the backside and just chase and tackle on a top front seven. And then once they extended him, he was then forced to be, you know, the anchor of the defense last year after McKinney went down. He played Mike linebacker as out position. And then this year there's some hope that him playing will again on this front seven, even though it wasn't, you know, a stacked front seven and all, just being back at will linebacker would help him. And it's been the same thing all over again. He doesn't read his keys well. He runs himself out of place a lot. He's missed a lot of tackles. He can't cover and never has been able to do so. And it's another one of those, like, Bill O'Brien decisions whenever he was general manager that were just part of the egregious and outlandish variety, you know?
Yeah, exactly. I mean, we'll have to see what the team wants to do with him. You know, I think we all know what the team should be doing with him in 2022. So, you know, the team tried to trade him in the offseason. They tried to trade him in the preseason. They tried to trade him at the deadline. If you can't find any trade partners now, you're not going to find any in the offseason. Mm-hmm. So it seems like just a release is inevitable for him.
Yeah, so this game, I don't really have any other thoughts from it just because it was, you know, as
such a blah game.
Exactly what you expect, you know. And it was just like the first one, too, where it's a bad run offense that has to run the ball going up against a great run defense. And even then, and it's like a poorly schemed offense that doesn't attack teams' weaknesses very well. On the opposite end of it, it was a really bad run defense going up against a great run offense that now their offensive line fully healthy, too. And so, yeah, it was exactly as you expected, and the Texans lost 31-0. And so with that part kind of out of the way, I kind of want to talk to you about this previous offseason and what the Texans may look to do this next upcoming offseason as well. And, you know, watching this team this year and looking at the salary cap stuff for this year too and for the future, I mean, one of the things that I just really didn't understand was that their contract restructures that they had. And so this year they have $43 million in dead money after releasing Merciless and trading Shaq Lawson, Bradley Roby, and Randall Cobb. Consider restructured Merciless, Lawson, Tunsil, Brandon Cooks, David Johnson, Zach Cunningham to create cap space for this season so they could do things like sign Neville Hewitt and Kevin Pierre-Lewis. Can you provide like the best reason you can think of that warranted the number of contract restructures that would limit their cap space for the following season?
I can't, and you know, it's tough to understand why they went that path. You know, before the offseason started, my natural assumption was, you know, they're going to release a few veterans and they're going to sign a buttload of undrafted players mm-hmm. or very young, inexpensive players to fill the roster up. You know, I was thinking like 25, 30 player undrafted class. Maybe they'll find a player or two out of that that's worth keeping for the long haul, but you know, a bulk of that would make the roster and just be a very young roster. And he went the complete 180 of what I thought. So in lieu of signing a huge undrafted class, and I don't know if this was a function of him being a first draft with a staff that he is not intimately familiar with. I know he's very close with James Lippert, you know, from his ties from New England, but it's not really his scouting staff. You know, generally when you have a GM come in at this point of the year, the bulk of the scouting's done. So you can't just swap them out. You usually wait the following year when the GM does his turnover and the scouting staff and the scouting department and personnel department get in who they want. So I kind of wonder if it was a function of A, COVID, when they had limited access to the back end draft players, mm-hmm. you know, the undrafted group players, things like that. In addition to not being intimately familiar with this scouting staff, and you know, maybe he just didn't have full trust in their evaluations. So given all that, and given his knowledge with James Lippert, that's where they opted to, in lieu of the undrafted class, let's go with a big free agent class. And it's going to cost a little bit more money. We can attempt to find players that are going to be in that $1 to $2 million range. And that's what they did. And so instead of going with the undrafted class, they went with, we could call it, you know, just a big giant free agent class and trying to find two or three players out of that group. It costs more money to go that route. Hence, that's why they need to restructure these contracts to make that method and that methodology work. You know, if they went with the big undrafted class, they would not have had to restructure so many contracts. So given the path that they took with the big free agent class, that's what necessitated all of the contract restructures.
That makes sense. That's the best reason I've heard for it. I completely disagree with that strategy for it, to make that decision to do so. But that's the only thing, like, that's the only reason why you would make the decision to go this, like, big bunch of veteran free agents and make the signings that they didn't in order to do so, you know, because of their own contract limitations. The restructures is what created it. But, like, that exact ideology, though, is why, you know, I didn't like Nick Caserio's offseason this year and still don't have, like, a good feel if he's going to be a good general manager or not, because it was a year of stagnation for Houston this year where, like, if you're not getting better, and if you're staying the same, you're still getting worse, you know? Like, if you stay at the exact same level, you're still getting worse because other teams are getting better and you and yourself are you know, digressing as well, too. And so there was just, like, a dichotomy between, you know, building for the future and building for this season. And then the veteran free agent contracts were an example of that. And also these guys are older, too. And so they probably be part of the next good Texans team as well anyways. It's not they went and signed, you know, guys like Cam Sims, who are 25 years old. They signed older players with that big batch of free agents that they signed this year. Their structures will limit the cap space for next year. They didn't try to collect a lot of draft picks in this year's draft, even though I do think they did a good job in this year's draft, aside from the Davis Mills selection. But there was just that, it was just a weird, just like how they had a clash between trying to be like a good team this year and building for a future. And whenever you're looking at a team without Watson, with the allure of, like, you know, maybe two or three top 10 draft picks next year, the lack of young talent on the roster, it seemed like the better idea was just be to pay these contracts out for this season, make the big moves next year to release them, to be able to minimize the dead cap space and maximize your cap space for, you know, 2022, instead of kind of like just dipping your toe in the water in 2021.
Yeah, and I have another small conspiracy theory when it comes to what they did this offseason. So okay. There's with this CBA, they changed the cash spending window from 4 years to 3 years, and they increased it to 90%. So essentially, the team has to spend 90% of their cap each year, accumulative over a 3 year period, in cash, not cap dollars, but cash. And so if you go and look at the cash spending for this year for the Texans, let's see here, they were midway through the pack, but they weren't bargain bin cash spending by any means. So their cash spending was right at just over 200 million. I think that this big free agent class, the additional cap spending with the restructures, allowed them to spend a little more cash and gives them that buffer room for 2022 and specifically 2023, when they're going to have many more draft picks on their team versus street free agents. Therefore, the cash is probably going to drop the next 2 years. So I think this cash spending for this year gives them that buffer towards that 90% and makes things a little easier if they need to back off the payroll for the next 2 years.
Yeah. So does that make that much of a difference in most teams' decisions during, you know, free agency and their own contract restructures and that sort of thing?
Yeah. I mean, there's some teams that don't care. I mean, you know,
what's the penalty for it if you don't pay the cash?
It's never happened, at least in the last CBA, but if they did, then they would have to go back to the players on that roster and give them, they basically would say, if we came up $3 million short, we'd find all the players that were on the roster for that year and divvy up the money between them all evenly. But it's never really happened. But there are teams that do struggle with meeting that threshold every year. It's teams like the Bengals. Oddly enough, usually it's the Cowboys, even though they're the Dak Prescott and extension this year really helped them out, just like the Watson thing helped out Texans last year. So the Cowboys are actually number one in cash spending this year, which is the first time in many years. They're usually at the very bottom. But the Colts, the Bengals, the Cowboys, the Texans are usually near the bottom when it comes to cash spending. So many teams like Atlanta, Los Angeles, the Rams, Philadelphia, Seattle, those teams, and Green Bay, obviously, surprisingly, with not having a direct owner, those teams would just blow cash spending out the window. So there's not too many teams that are concerned with it, but there are a few teams at the bottom, like I said, like the Colts, like the Bengals, that will try to use that that little clause to limit some of their free agent work. But it doesn't happen often, but it is a factor in there for some teams. I mean, I preach this all the time. People talk about how, you know, like next year, if we make certain moves and we're going to have teams going to have $60, $70 million in cap space, we're going to be able to go spend out the wazoo. Not really. Teams have a cash budget, you know, just because you have $50 million in available cap space doesn't mean the team has $50 million that they can spend.
Or the owner's willing to spend, you know.
Right, yeah. Every year the team sets a cash budget and they're going to spend to that cap budget. And cap dollars is basically an accounting function, an allocation of their cash. So, you know, all those things will factor into what a team is or is not able to do in free agency. But I just wanted to throw that out there for the Texans. It may be completely off, but that's just one of my thoughts with their heavy cash spending this year. With their contract restructures, it just gives them a little buffer on the next 2 years when it comes to the cash window.
Gotcha. That makes sense. I haven't heard that at all before. And yeah, I mean, it seems like it could play like some of a factor in it. I still think even with the repercussions from it, you'd still be better off just kind of going all in on, you know, using this as like a gap year, so that way you can actually start the rebuild fully next year after the Watson contract, and then also and just kind of like jumpstart it too. Because like I think by all means, you know, this was a lost season. Where they didn't really find anybody for next year, and then they found a lot of cornerstone players at all. I think the only good things you can say is that Jonathan Grenard's like Whitney Merciless and could be the, you know, third best player on a really good front seven. You know, Nico Collins may be like a possible number two wide receiver, but I think he's quarterback dependent, and it's hard to know exactly what you may get out of him. I think now that we have Howard at left tackle, there's some like, you know, something actually good there, and like the interior of the defensive line's in a pretty good spot too. But like that still is kind of like you'd expect to find out more about your own roster and more about, you know, what maybe is something of a cornerstone player, and even for most rebuilding teams too.
Yeah, and yeah, I was hoping Caserio would kind of go scorched earth, kind of what Reggie McKinney did with Oakland at the time, where he just offloaded as many contracts as he could and just accumulated all the dead money in 1 year and then started fresh after that and laid a great foundation for Mayock and Gruden to take over. And, you know, but as you mentioned, there's really no just major cornerstone players to hang your hat on with this roster. There's some quality players to build around, but there's just no, man, that's the guy you want to build around. That's one of your just pure foundational pieces. The building's going to start shaking if you remove him, kind of thing. So that's the unfortunate part about this, and hopefully he'll find some foundation players in, you know, the next draft or two, because there's really not any strong building pieces on this roster at the moment.
Yeah, and I guess like that's the only good thing about like the draft this past year is that they did find, you know, a few good players in it. I think Brevin Jordan's production has been kind of overrated because he's had some problems beating man coverage, and they don't use him as a blocker at all. But like, yeah, he's a better route runner than, you know, Farrell Brown is, and he's pretty much the same player as Jordan Akins at the moment, but isn't like, you know, 30 years old like he is. And Lopez is going to be a starting, you know, run stopping defensive tackle who has some, you know, has the ability to collapse the pocket a little bit too. And then Collins may be a number two wide receiver. And so I think given their like draft capital they had this year, I think they did a good job, you know, building around it, even though they didn't cast that UDFA net too. But that's the only thing that gives me sort of hope for Caserio being the guy who, you know, builds the next good Texans team.
Yeah, no, I agree with you. And there's, like I said, there's plenty of players on this roster, and you can use two hands to count it up. I mean, there's more than a few players to build a future around. It's just you're still looking for that cornerstone piece.
Yeah, I can.
Whether it's the, you know, which is obviously the quarterback. So, you know, we'll see what happens.
Yeah. So looking at next offseason, this is all according to Over the Cap, the place that you do some work at too. The Texans have 27 players under contract and are projected to have $40 million in cap space. And with these are including, this is not including like really easy cuts like Marcus Cannon for $6.3 million, Eric Murray with $5.2 million, Fairbairn at 1.9, Mitchell at 3, Parrott Lewis at 3.5, Jenkins at 3. These are all like kind of cut options that you kind of alluded to that, you know, they may be able to get up to like $60 or $70 in cap space, and that's not including, you know, possible Tunsil trade or releasing Cunningham as well. So I do think the Texans are in a good spot, cap wise to be able to add talent next offseason? Or are you think this is gonna be kind of like another gap year with the way this is kind of looking at the moment?
No, I think from a cap standpoint, I think they're perfectly fine. As you mentioned, they have five moves right off the bat from the start of the offseason that they can make with Murray, Cannon, Cunningham, Fairbairn, and Pierre Lewis that'll bump them up. You know, right now the calculator on OTC will push that number up to $59 million in cap space. Just got to keep in mind that the team will sign a good bulk of futures contracts in January, so that'll eat up probably, I think, like $8 or $9 million in cap space. So just keep that in mind. So even with those moves, you're still looking at $50 million before you even do a trade for Tutsal or Watson. So the team has a ton of cap space to work with, and they'll probably, you know, like we said, the cash is going to be the king on this. So it's all going to be up to how much cash McNair wants to spend for 2022. And they'll probably kind of spread out. I think they'll probably spread out that cap space over the next 2 or 3 years. I don't foresee them diving in heads first into 2022 and using a ton of that cap space up. You know, you might start seeing back to the Rick Smith and Chris Olsen days when they drafted Watson and were carrying, you know, $25, $30, $40 million of cap space over from year over year in preparation of what they had coming down the road with Watson and other extensions. So I think you're probably going to see that same kind of reset again. You know, he'll hopefully we'll see a few key big name signings out there. Free agency, unfortunately, is just a giant crapshoot. Your hit rate on free agent signing is extremely low.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it's very rare that you're going to have a Jonathan Joseph type signing that has impact and has continued impact for year over year. So you hope to get a year or two out of your free agent class, and, you know, we'll probably see a big name or two, but I wouldn't expect him just to go all crazy with it.
Yeah.
And so they're in great shape. It's all going to come down to what kind of cash he's going to be able to spend or be willing to spend, you know, whether or not he kind of continues that same mentality of having a heavy middle class on the roster. That was a big staple in New England. They didn't have a top heavy from a cap dollar standpoint, didn't have like a very top heavy roster when you have, you know, six players taking up 60% of your cap.
Mm-hmm.
In New England, it was more the middle class. Once you got past the top five charges, the next 30 players were all, they weren't minimum pay players. They were all, you know, minimum, you know, a million up to $2.5 million. It was just a very big middle class. You know, my buddy who does the same thing that I do for the Patriots, he tells me every year that the Patriots always have the largest number of players on their roster that have a cap charge between $1 million and $3 million compared to the rest of the league. So it'd be interesting to see, and that's in place now for 2021. Yeah. I'd be curious to see how that roster construction is going to go forward now that he'll be able to include more draft picks. You know, especially if he trades Watson and or Tunsil, he's going to have a bulk, a gigantic amount of draft picks for the next 3 years. So it'd be interesting to see the roster construction from that standpoint as well going forward.
Yeah, that is interesting. I'm just hoping he just like signs good players, you know, and
that's ultimate at the end of the day. I mean, you can talk like dollars and, you know, you got to do this, you got to do that. Sign good players. That I mean, it's easier said than done, but yeah, that's the ultimate goal, is find players that contribute. And it doesn't matter what the cost is or how your roster is constructed at the end of the day, if you're signing quality players that contribute to your team.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, like it's just kind of like, I think the biggest example, like the Patriots versus the Texans when Ever O'Brien was GM, was that, you know, the Texans gave Eric Murray that ludicrous contract, and then you watch the Patriots give Adrian Phillips, you know, 2 years, $7 million, and he's probably like one, like the 15, like as far as like the strong safeties goes, like he's one of the probably top 15 strong safeties in football, who, you know, makes a lot of plays, who just had some injury problems previously. And like, that's like the top, like that's a Patriots signing for you. You know, you don't pay a guy a contract he would never get anywhere else. You pay a guy, you know, 2 years, $7 million, or, you know, 2 years, $6 million, and you get 2 years out of him, and you're able to just, like, get a good football player who makes plays out of it, you know?
Yeah, and that's always what you hope for in free agency, is to find that second, that player in the second and third wave that gives you the same impact that a first wave player would potentially give you for, you know, 60% of the cost. So, mm-hmm. you know, I think that's probably where Casera is going to do a bulk of his work again, is in wave two and wave three. We'll see what happens. The biggest thing that I'm curious about is how he values pass rush versus coverage.
Yeah.
And then if he's willing to pay wide receivers.
Yeah.
You know, New England typically did not pay wide receivers. Bill O'Brien did not like paying wide receivers. He very much, off the record, I heard that he was never wanted to, he didn't want to pay Will Fuller. He didn't like the Hopkins contract. He did not like the amount of money that those receivers, he felt like, you know, I'd rather have four wide receivers making $7-8 million a pop versus one guy making 16 and one guy making, you know, rookie mm-hmm. money. So it'd be curious. I'm curious. That's the two, the three position groups. And I'm really curious to see how Casario values on a, from a money and cap standpoint, if he's willing to pay those positions or which ones he's willing to pay, if he's willing to pay a defensive back over a pass rusher or vice versa.
Yeah, that's interesting. And I think also like the way they're kind of built too, and like it also kind of depends on what scheme they kind of run also, that just like your front four pass rush and Lovie Smith defense is more important than your quarterback play. And so how much of a contribution like Lovie Smith's defense you kind of lends to it, I think will be interesting too. But yeah, you know, Bruce Ellington and Darren Fells really warped, you know, Bill O'Brien's mind while he was the head coach here. And so looking here at Deshaun Watson, he has a cap hit of $40 million next year, $35 million in salary and $5 million in bonus. The Texans would save $24.2 million by trading him. Do you think his contract is going to hinder the Texans' ability to trade him all next year? And what's your ideal Deshaun Watson trade package at the moment?
Oh, I am torn between just straight up draft picks, or if it's draft picks and players. You know, I, you know, part of me is, you know, because I don't know if there's any quarterbacks in this draft class. I haven't really dug into the draft class yet, but you know, we'll see what happens. The contract isn't trade prohibitive by any means. I mean, the bulk of the heavy money has already been paid out by the Texans. So there's really nothing to to hold them back from that. I mean, any team that's getting this contract is actually getting a pretty good deal. And on top of that, since his salary is so large for 2022, anybody who gets his contract, the first thing they can do is restructure yeah. it and find a ton of cap dollars. Because the prorated bonus money is going to stay with Houston. So they're going to have a huge – any receiving team can just take that contract, restructure it, and just create $20 plus million easy in cap space. So it's going to be cheap. So the contract's not a prohibiting factor. My, you know, if you know, let's just say – I wouldn't even know. We'll just say Miami's, you know, who they're looking at trading with. You know, at this point, there's really nobody on their team that really – interest me from a player standpoint, so it would have to be a bulk of draft picks. You know, whether that's, let's assume for the sake of this exercise that Watson is not indicted and he ends up settling come February-ish. You know, let's just assume those things happen, then it should easily get three first and a couple of twos, or at least three ones and a two, and you know, maybe a day three pick or something like that. That's got to be the minimum if everything cleans up with his legal issues. If he gets indicted or something else happens, or he ends up going through his deposition, which he should not and hopefully does not have to go through that deposition for his sake,
mm-hmm.
which is going to happen in February, that's where trade value might become an issue. So the Texans, by holding off this past trade deadline, put a pretty big bet on what's going to happen
yeah.
with him and what they can get out, what kind of trade assets they can get back. So if they found a team that had some young players, you know, if you could get a good edge rusher a good defensive back. I'm not really interested in wide receivers. I think you can find those in the draft pretty easily. But I think if you can get a pass rusher and or a good defensive back, preferably a cornerback that fits your scheme, in addition to the draft picks, then that's fine too.
Mm-hmm.
You know, there's really nobody out there that interests me from getting a return quarterback. You know, like I say, this is not probably a plausible situation, but just for the sake of an example, if you were to trade with like Cleveland to get Baker Mayfield back as a reclamation project or something like that.
Yeah.
I don't know if there's really any, or New York Giants and you get back Daniel Jones as, you know, as a reclamation project. I really don't see that as a benefit. I'd rather just go out and get a Teddy Bridgewater or Marcus Mariota or something like that in free agency. So suffice to say, short answer is probably draft picks. And if there's a very capable young player, then I'm on board with that as well.
Yeah. I mean, I think two guys in Miami that stand out are Javon Holland, because he could just replace Justin Reed as a deep middle safety. And Jordan Phillips is like a really good 3-4 edge run defender already. And he's been his pass rush acumen's really jumped up the past, you know, 3 weeks as well, too. Mine's still the New York Giants, because you get picks number 6-7. And I think that would be enough for me to make the trade. You can kind of figure out the little bit things aside from there. You know, maybe Daniel Jones has some sort of Ryan Tannehill potential playing in like a non-stupid offense after, you know, Jason Garrett not having any idea that he's a good vertical passer the last 2 years there, and the problems that they've had their offensive line, the Saquon Barkley injury, and all that's never fully like meshed out. And like, at least with Jones, like, you know, he has speed and he can throw the ball deep downfield. And if you build like a good play action passing attack around that, maybe there's something there. But I just like the ability to get, you know, two top 10 picks in this draft, and then that way you have one of your own and you could trade down with one of those and grab a quarterback and, like, you know, pick 15, maybe pick another first round pick after that. And then that'd be enough for me, just considering the Watson, you know, legal allegations. I don't think there'd be that much of a kind of question that he wouldn't want to play for New York, considering the market. And I think the Giants also are just kind of desperate to be good after having the bad run they've had since McAdoo and Eli Manning for the last, you know, 6-7 years or so.
Yeah, the Giants are an interesting team for this. And I say that for a couple reasons. A, their owner, John Mara, he's a pretty conservative guy.
He's cranky, and so, too. He's real cranky nowadays.
he does flip-flop a lot on things. He's not very consistent. But I say conservative because, and it makes me, you know, he was big behind the Tontine rule and all that stuff. And he's very old school when it comes to the game. And so I wonder if that mentality carries over with player perception, specifically with Watson, if that's something he would be interested in having associated with his team, regardless of the outcome of Watson's situation. And on top of that, the other factor to that is, it sounds like by all accounts Gettleman's out, so you got a new GM coming in. Is the new GM going to want to make this huge splash and trade away tons of draft capital? You know, specifically, you know, if he traded away six and seven this year, 38 this year, and a one in 2023, potentially more, you know, even 2024. Is he willing to do all that to land Watson and make a big splash coming out right out the gate? Maybe that's the marching orders that Mara gives him, or as a new GM. I guess it obviously just depends on the GM that comes in there. If it's a young guy who's not willing to make that kind of splash, or if it's, you know, I'm trying to remember the Chiefs GM. God, what was his name?
The one before Veach. Pioli? Was it Pioli?
No, before Veach, and then he went, Buddy Boy. He always calls Chris Ballard. I can't remember his name now. He always say, hey, Buddy Boy. You know, he was a very aggressive GM and made those big splashes. So, and that would be the kind of GM that would make that kind of move for, you know, that's the kind, you know, so it just depends on what type of GM comes in there and kind of what perception Mara has of Watson. But the Giants, yeah, I mean, that would be a fantastic situation for the Texans to get that kind of draft capital. And then you take that 6-7 and start just trading back. I mean, maybe you use one of them, you know, for a key component, but maybe start trading back and accumulate and build off of that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's my, like, kind of a Deshaun Watson, like, ideal scenario for Houston. I think the other thing about the Giants, too, is that they're kind of like a built-out roster. You know, they've drafted high already a lot in the draft. They used their free agency dollars last year. they're kind of like a team of, it kind of feels like it's a quarterback away and some injury luck, and you expect there to be some defensive improvement next year after having like a really bad run defense this season too. So the last question I have for you, and I kind of want to do like a rapid fire for next offseason with the four biggest contracts the Texans have. So okay. Laremy Tunsil is at $26 million cap hit for next year. Zach Cunningham at $12.8 million. Brandon Cooks at $16.2 million. How do you think the Texans are going to handle these three players next offseason?
So Tunsil, trade, Cunningham release, Murray release, Cooks, and keep around. His contract voids after the 2022 season, so I think he'll stay as is.
Yeah, that's the way I see it as well, too. And I think, and even like Tunsil, you're kind of mentioning if you trade Tunsil to another team, or with Watson, if you traded him, they can always just restructure the contract, create cap space. I think with Tunsil, if you trade him, they would just extend him right away and then drop down that, you know, his guaranteed salary for this upcoming season, then give him 4 or 5 years or whatever and try to keep him there long term. But yeah, I can't imagine a team actually trading thing for Cunningham considering his contract and just how bad he's been. And so I think that's just going to be a sunk cost that you have to eat.
Yep, I agree.
All right, so I got one more question for you since that went fast. How soon do you think it's going to be until we see another good Houston Texans team?
I would say probably 2024. I base that off the fact that they probably don't find a quarterback in this coming draft, which means you're drafting your quarterback in 2023, which more than likely means you're looking at, you know, 6-7 wins with that quarterback. So 2024, before we really start really turning the corner, unless they just find a put together a fantastic roster in the offseason for 2022, you know, and find a bridge option at the quarterback.
Mm-hmm.
So that would be my guess, that you start seeing really meaningful wins. You know, there'll be excitement starting building in 2023. You'll start seeing, you know, say they got the drafted rookie quarterback, you know, and you got a big name out there and he's, you know, getting 5-6 wins that first year, but he's building on something. They're building on something. They really got something going. Then 2024 is the year that, you know, you really start making that big push.
Yeah, I can see that, and that's the way I see it too. If they hit in the draft, that like probably by 2024 they could have a good football team again. And like the other thing is, like, people kind of forget that rebuilds can and should be pretty quick in the NFL. And like if you have like one really great draft class, like we saw with the Colts in 2018, you know, that can spring your team, you know, pretty quickly and dramatically. And if you have a good coaching staff around it too, like they're able to get with, you know, Reich and Eberflus as well too. And so you can change pretty fast. But like the fear, of course, is that something happens with Watson, they can't trade him because of the legal stuff, or they don't get the package that they expected to get, and they miss on the draft picks, you know, this upcoming year. And then if that happens, you know, if they don't springboard the Watson trade, it may be a very long time until they're a good football team again. But the same side of the coin, or the other side of the coin, if you nail the Watson trade, I do agree. I think by 2024, they should be able to be a playoff team already.
Yep. Completely agree.
Well, that's all I got for tonight, Troy. We have a lot of these listener questions, but we have a lot of them, and it's, you know, we're dads on school nights, and so I don't take up too much more of your time, but I'm sure I'll get them in some sort of mailbag or something on another date. But so, Troy, where can we find your stuff? What do you have going on? And make sure to tell us how to check out the cap and trade, you know, listing room thing on Twitter as well too. That was a lot of fun to do last week.
Yeah, so you can follow me on Twitter at Texans Cap. I haven't been writing as much as I used to in the past, but you know, I do a lot of the contract data over thecap.com. And then yeah, on Tuesday nights at 9 p.m. Central Time, we do cap and trade on Twitter Spaces. So we do it live. So we rotate and get different guests every week. You know, Matt was on with me this past week. Landry Locker and Mike Meltzer will be with me tomorrow night. And so we do those weekly every night, and then they're turned over as podcasts later in the week for folks who can't listen in. But those on Tuesday night, they're really fun. You know, we have a lot of fan interaction. People come in, ask their questions. It's, you know, the listeners kind of drive the show on those Tuesday night episodes. So if you're available around 9 o'clock on Tuesday nights, you know, hop in, just hop on your phone on Twitter and join in.
Yeah. And I'm definitely going to try to tune in tomorrow. I've listened to a couple of the episodes, you know, during the year recorded, and I didn't check out the Twitter space thing, so we did yesterday, but whenever I'm watching Jonathan Taylor, you know, have the carry number 30, you know, for 250 yards, I'm making a movie of every Cam McGregor Hill tackle. I'm going to try and make sure I can, you know, turn in and listen to that tomorrow night. I'm looking forward to it.
Sounds good, man. We'll be looking out for you.
So that's our show for tonight. We'll be having our weekly preview show probably on Wednesday for Thursday morning. And we'll, of course, be talking about the Texans-Seahawks game, you know, sometime in the near future. Until next time, I'm Matt Weston. Thank you for listening to Bowery Radio. And thank you for being on tonight, Troy.
Appreciate you for having me, buddy. We'll do this again sometime.
Hi, this is Scott Galloway, professor of marketing at NYU Stern School of Business and host of the Prof G Pod. If you don't know me, the New York Times calls me the Howard Stern of business. Gary Swisher, super friggin' insightful, and Elon Musk, an insufferable numbskull. I think we're going to make up. I think we're going to go somewhere and do ketamine together. Each week on my show, the Prop G Pod, we bring you insights from Blue Flame thinkers, including my nemesis, Adam Grant. Super smart guy. My nemesis because he's really good. Or one of our favorite journalists, Fareed Zakaria. Fareed's a total gangster. And not only that, we provide listeners with a markets-driven episode every Monday. We answer our listeners' questions about business, big tech, and career pivots every Wednesday and get to listen to the sweet sound of George Hahn reading our newsletter every Saturday. That's right. The Prop G Pod is in your feeds four times a week. I'm like AOL in the 90s. To resist is futile. Put your hand into a box of cereal. Is it a tasty, sugary snack? Nope. It's the dog.